I picture the poet John Keats sitting in his desk, quill pen in hand, ready to write. Behind him are the stacks of books that have instructed and inspired him. But what he can't get out of his head is his brother's painful and ultimately losing battle, like his mother's, with tuberculosis. He cannot escape the horrible image of his brother coughing up blood uncontrollably. And now, Keats himself has begun to cough up blood. It feels like a death sentence. He is filled with fears that he soon may cease to be. His hand with the pen poised doesn't move. No words are coming. He glances at his books, but he doesn't think he's likely to find any answers there. Not in scripture, not in the scientific books, not even in his beloved books of poetry that he has collected. So he gets up, and he sets out for the only place he can think to go at this moment, the beach. Nature is where Keats always turns when he is deeply disturbed or perplexed. Standing on the beach when he's looking out at the relentless waves coming in, he feels something deep stir within him most times. There is a power on the beach, a power mysterious and inscrutable. I can picture that day, a blustery March day. Cool wind, beautiful sunny sky. Standing there in the immensity and the infinity of ocean and beach on that troubled day, he feels an answer to his fear arrive, like as if on the waves. The answer is not, "Don't worry, John, you're going to be fine." He knows he has tuberculosis. He knows from his brother's experience and his mother's experience and so many other people he's loved, he knows that this is probably not going to end well for him. He knows that someday, perhaps soon, he will never again stand on this beach. Nothing in his experiences that day in the beach tell him otherwise. No false hope rides in on the waves, as much as he might have liked that to happen. Instead, he feels a oneness with the cycle of life, a cycle that keeps on going like those waves keep on washing ashore. He is part of this amazing world, connected to it. But the world is bigger than he is, and it will be fine without him. Maybe, he realizes, maybe feeling a part of this miraculous world, however briefly, maybe that is answer enough. In that moment, he gets a taste of transcendence. His fears quieted, he returns to his desk, and the words begin to come, and the poem we heard is written. Anyway, that's how I imagine it going. The question Keats faced at his desk and at the beach is a question which we all face sooner or later. Even if we are the king or queen of denial, life forces us to wrestle with this ultimate fear of ceasing to be, at least in this current form and location. I'm certain that a number of you in this room have had your Keats moments, those moments of truth when you have stared at the reality of your own mortality in a very palpable way. Maybe it's a cancer diagnosis, a car accident. There are so many different things that can trigger that moment of truth. And I would argue that Keats' answer on the beach that day was an excellent answer. In fact, I would also argue that it was a skeptical answer. And I'm guessing that skeptical is not a word you thought of as you heard that poem. And I'm guessing that Keats wouldn't have thought of it either, nor did he think of himself as a skeptical person. But skeptical, yeah. I think skeptical is a great description for it. You see, on the beach, he did not lose the critical component of thinking and feeling. His feeling wasn't, "This blood you're coughing up is nothing, you're going to be fine, maybe you'll even live forever." His answer was not like that, like the guy, like this family I saw when I was working in a hospital as a chaplain in Chicago, where this young man had been shot in the head and was brain dead. And the family's there saying, I think there's going to be a miracle. I think he's going to live. And I'm thinking, he's brain dead. I don't think he is. For Keats, that wasn't that kind of answer that he got. Part of the answer that he got survives any sort of critical test. That part that said, I'm part of the world, at least for this moment anyway. I'm part of it now, and at some point, I will not be anymore, at least in this current form. Those statements are demonstrably true. But another part of his answer is more problematic, that the world is really big and amazing. That's not something you can necessarily prove rationally. Actually, there's lots of ways to view the world. Maybe even this particular universe is just this tiny speck in the scope of the immensity of our universe and maybe other universes beyond. And amazing? Yeah, this could be amazing, or maybe it's not amazing. That's a value judgment, isn't it? And what does it mean to say that you're connected to the world, a part of all that is, as he powerfully felt on that beach? The fact of connection, which is indisputable, is different from the meaning of connection. And I think for Keats, it was the meaning of connection that counted that day. So parts of the answer that Keats heard that day were not purely rational. But I think all the parts were important, and what's more, I think all the parts of the poem, parts of his answer, stand the test of skepticism, if we look at skepticism broadly. And so what I want to suggest today is that we need a more expansive understanding of what it means to be skeptical, more expansive than mere rationality. When we understand skepticism expansively, I think it can be an amazing tool for inquiry and for the spiritual journey. It certainly was for Keats in that extremely confounding and painful moment in his life. The truths we uncover in our spiritual journeys help us, I believe, to live our lives as well as possible and as wide awake as possible. Inquiry that contains skepticism, broadly understood then, is an indispensable tool in the spiritual journey. The roots of the word skeptical lie in the ancient Greek language, and a good translation for them is thoughtful. In my dictionary, there's a wonderful definition of thoughtful that hints at what I mean by this expanded understanding of skepticism. Occupied with or given to thought, the definition goes, contemplative, meditative, reflective. Reflective. That's the word I like best. And there are lots of ways to be reflective. Thinking is an important one, but it's not the only one. Alone on the beach that day, Keats was reflective. He was thoughtful, but he was using more than just the rationality component of his brain, you know, disconnected from his body and his imagination and his poetic sense. He was using all those faculties to come up with an answer that spoke to him. Truth, with a small t, comes in many different ways and forms and shapes. When we understand skepticism as being only about the rationality component of our brain, our understanding is simply too narrow. We stifle the rich possibilities of inquiry and consequently our spiritual path. The broad spectrum of ways of knowing, that's what it means. That's what we need to use in our spiritual journey. So thinking rationally is one, but we need to use our imaginations, our bodies, our artistic sensibilities. So what does skepticism mean in this broader understanding? First of all, it means not accepting truths as absolute, capital T, now and for all eternity. It means bringing a healthy dose of doubt to all of our reflections. The skeptic doubts and questions the truths she has been taught. The skeptic even doubts the truths that he has come to embrace. So, what's different in this expanded understanding from skepticism, from this more narrow kind that it just is a rational enterprise. What's different about it is that we can draw on these different sources of knowledge. So Keats on the beach listens to the body, his body, telling him, man, your days are numbered. He listens to his mind saying, yeah, I think that actually is true. He listens to the waves and to the wind and to the beauty. And he listens to the expansiveness and the interconnectedness of that scene on the beach. And he comes to embrace the truth that he will die probably soon, but that there is meaning in being connected to this amazing world even for a short time. And then I suspect he doesn't hold on to that truth as the absolute truth, impervious to any additional emphasis, truth with a capital T. His conclusion that day, in other words, to me, is a thoroughly skeptical conclusion. As I thought about the sermon this week, I ran across a podcast of an interview with Jennifer Michael Hecht, and she was the author of Doubt, A History. She articulates in this podcast a more expansive understanding of the multiple ways we acquire knowledge. And she's a person who straddles different worlds. She is a very, very renowned historian of science, and she's also a poet. And so she's one of those few people, at least that I know, that can bring together the worlds of science and poetry and let them speak to each other in complementary ways. Her words suggest to me that ultimately the trick is, a trick which I think Keats accomplished on the beach, to integrate what we learn from these different forms of knowledge. So in this interview, and she does talk about the Keats poem in the interview too, that's what led me to it, but in this interview, she shares a story that comes from the Rationalist Society of St. Louis. That's one of these old societies focused on rationalism. Goes back to the 1940s. And she tells a story about a guy who came to share with the Rationalist Society some paper. And in the midst of the paper, he said, you know, he actually got something out of Harry Potter. And a lot of people in the Rationalist Society audience were aghast at that idea. It's fantasy, one of them said, meaning it's not real, so you can't get anything out of it. Well, Hecht said, and I agree, that actually you can get a lot out of Harry Potter. Now, you can't get history out of it. It actually didn't happen. It is fantasy. But you can certainly get some meaning and some truth with a small t. If you're a kid reading Harry Potter, and maybe you're not the most imposing kid physically, or maybe you're growing up in a family that makes the Dursley family look functional, or maybe you're the victim of bullying by some version of Malfoy and Crabbe and Goyle. Well, I can imagine you could find a lot of truth and meaning in Harry Potter. I know in my own life I have, even as an adult. In fact, when my mom died, Harry Potter was one of the lenses with which I worked through my mom's death. You don't have to believe literally in the world of wizards and magic in order to find truth, small t, in Harry Potter. Friday night, I was captivated yet again by Les Miserables. I went to the amazing show at Appleton North High School. It's such a moving story about sin and repentance and redemption. Most of all, maybe it's about the truth sung by the three deceased heroes at the end. To love another person is to see the face of God. Did Les Mis actually happen? Well, no. I mean, it's historical fiction, but let's put the emphasis on fiction. The background story happened, but everything that's featured in that, no, that didn't happen. It's really not any more real than Harry Potter. But the play conveys knowledge and meaning. And that's why I saw it for the umpteenth time, and why, if it's still at the cheap seats, I'm going to go see it there too. And then there's the story of the Buddhas leaving the sheltered palace of his childhood and finding out the truth about life and death and suffering. There's the story of that moment of death at which he attained final enlightenment. I return to those stories again and again in my sermons and in my own spiritual journey. Same with the stories of Jesus' birth in that simple stable and this miraculous resurrection from the dead after his brutal execution. Did any of these things really happen? I don't think so. I can't imagine they happened. There's no shred of historic evidence that these things happen, and I don't care anyway. But again, there is a form of knowledge that can come from reflecting on them in the same way it can come from thinking about Harry Potter or Les Mis. Skepticism, narrowly defined as pure rationality, well, that would compel me to throw all these stories out as not helpful because they weren't real, they aren't scientifically provable. Skepticism, more broadly defined, to include embodied knowledge and imagination and artistic sensibility and myth, that can bring those stories in to create meaning. So maybe I can learn something from them. So I continue to consult these stories. Someday when I have my own Keats moment, that moment of being overwhelmed with the reality that I'm mortal, I have a hunch that the Buddha and Jesus and, yes, even Harry Potter will be with me there on the beach, helping me make sense out of that. And they will not be there with certain answers, you know, for sure answers. They won't be there with ideas that insult my rationality. My rationality will be part of the conversation too. But the whole of me will come to some understanding, some answer. Over the past couple hundred years, a narrow understanding of skepticism as rationality only has really stifled Unitarian Universalism. And I'm hopeful, and I truly am hopeful, that we've begun to emerge from that slumber. For too long, our congregations venerated the curmudgeons who, in services and meetings and small groups and one-on-one conversations, relentlessly shouted that the only true source of information and knowledge, the only source that mattered, is rationality. And they shouted all too often that if you don't believe that, you're either an idiot or, worse, a fraud. With these curmudgeons setting the tone, we didn't have to check our brains at the door, which is a really good thing, but we did have to check our emotions and our poetry and our myths. We were just a bunch of disembodied neocortexes, try to visualize that, sitting around trying to make sense out of things. And guess what? We were doomed to failure because we were only using one source of knowledge. So what I say today is, yes, bring your skepticism to the fellowship, but don't just play that skepticism in one key. And I hope that all of us will bring with us in this door always a whole bunch of doubt about whatever small truths we choose to embrace. Whatever truths we embrace may be wrong. They may be misleading. They may be really good for now, but not good tomorrow. So let's reflect together, skeptically, using our brains, our imaginations, our stories, our intuition, and our bodies, and our experiences. And I would say, let's keep having fun doing this. There's something that's really cool about doing this reflection in a playful spirit. Again, now Keats on the beach, I don't think he's thinking he's being playful at all. But I do believe that in a way he was on the beach and at his desk, as he let his rationality and his poetic sensibility and his imagination and his body, in a sense, play with each other, dance with each other. Perhaps whatever medical understandings or misunderstandings he had of tuberculosis, perhaps those were dancing with the poem we heard from Wordsworth that was written about the same time as the choir sang. Perhaps his encounter with Hindu cosmology danced with his understanding of the enormity of space and that relatively new idea then that the Earth wasn't at the center of the universe. Perhaps he had seen a coastal landscape portrait by the artist Turner, and that was playing in his head, along with this persistent irritation in his lung. Maybe all these things were dancing together, all these forms of knowledge, and a truth came to him through all these. To me, that's inquiry. That's the kind of spirituality I can aspire to. Finding and cultivating and growing in this way is why I keep coming back to this place, week after week, month after month, year after year, as life's challenges and mysteries keep on washing ashore right in front of me.